You're listening to a sermon by Gary Janssen, recorded on Sunday, November 16, 2008, at the Point Grey Inter-Mennonite Fellowship in Vancouver, British Columbia. The opinions expressed by the speaker are not necessarily those of the church. This recording is licensed for personal use by individuals only and may not be copied, broadcast, or redistributed without the prior permission of the church board. For more information, please visit our website at pgimf.org.
Well, I'm just going to follow up a little bit on what Carl has been alluding to here and just say a little bit of more. It was quite interesting, actually, on January 1st of this year, my beginning of being full-time in this new job, I was on an airplane to Saskatchewan to go see my parents. My mother had just had a brain aneurysm on Boxing Day, and she was barely alive and in hospital, and spent a week in Saskatchewan with my parents. She's never come home since then, but I'm just very thankful. I got an email from my brother this week saying Mom got a phone installed in her room. She's in the Rostron Mennonite Nursing Home. My dad is down the hallway now. He's moved. He's 90 years old, and she's just turning 80. He moved into the assisted living there, and so they're under the same roof in the larger complex of the Rostron Mennonite Nursing Home complex in Saskatchewan, and it's just very comforting to be here. And my brother said, you know what, Mom got a phone put in. And the neat thing about, I can just jackrabbit trail here a little bit, the neat thing about being here today is the singing. And I've worked hard many years of my life to learn the tenor line, and it just so happens that having a good piano who actually plays the notes that we're looking for, and having so many good voices around, it sure makes it easy to find that tenor line. My mother always sang the alto line, and she sung in trios and quartets, and she sung all her life. Just a few weeks ago, the choir from the local seniors center in Rostron came to the nursing home, and they invited her to come join them to sing with them. She had not sung since her aneurysm on Boxing Day of last year, and she sang with them. And someone had told my dad that once Evelyn, my mom's name, once she starts singing, her voice will start coming back. She had this very weak voice. Dad could hardly hear her. And her voice came back. Right, you know, it just immediately increased in strength as soon as she started singing again. And it was that Sunday morning when the choir was there. And and her comprehension, her ability to process thoughts has significantly increased. And I phoned yesterday because my brother said she's got a phone in her room. Well, I thought, you know, what's this going to be like? And it was just like old times. It was just unbelievable. It was so good. So I talked to Diane, my wife, said, you know what, you should pick up the other phone. And she says, okay, well, I'll probably not speak because Mom might get confused. And I said, you know what, Mom's at a different place. And we had this wonderful conversation. So she might move back in with Dad, who's got a double room down the hall, you know, in the assisted living. But she's kind of been enjoying her independence. But if they kick her out of the nursing home kind of type of care, she may have to move back in with him. Well, I bring greetings from Mennonite Church BC, very thankful for your part in that as one of our congregations and as a congregation. Yesterday we were at the Mennonite Central Committee MCC annual meetings, and it's always and my office is at Columbia Bible College, and these are all indications of how the church, Mennonite Church and the Mennonite Brethren work together, and this congregation is also one of those indications of how we can work together, and I'm very thankful. I've had really good fellowship with the president at Columbia Bible College, Ron Penner. In fact, so good that I kicked him out of his office, which Mennonite Church BC office was on the third floor in the back, and the Mennonite Brethren Board of Mission and Services needed that whole floor. Like, they needed everything, and so we were asked to move, and Ron Penner was so gracious to say, well, you can have my office. And Ron, the president of Columbia Bible College, moved down the hallway and gave Mennonite Church BC the upfront office. So when you come into the Resource Center at Columbia Bible College, on the right-hand side is the main people you talk to if you want to know something about Columbia Bible College, and on the left-hand side is Mennonite Church BC. So it's a pretty nice place to be, and very thankful for that relationship that we share with the college and together with the Mennonite Brethren. My counterpart in the Mennonite Brethren, Steve Berg, he and I have become good friends, and I'll talk about this a little bit later, but shared fellowship on a trip to Palestine, Israel, earlier this year. I was also going to comment about dessert. By the way, last night, my son, my 18-year-old son, Jonathan, our youngest one, he revealed something last night. He says, you know what? At school all these years, and even now at home, I eat my dessert first. He revealed that. His mother likes sweets a lot, too. And he said, you know, the only reason he eats his dessert first is because he was always rushing through his food to get at the dessert. And so he would eat his food so quickly that he didn't enjoy it. Whereas his mother said she eats her food slowly in anticipation of the great event at the end. But he said, I'm going to get the great event out of the way first because I like that, and then I can actually take the rest of it more slowly. It's been done. It's been done. Yeah. In our scripture text today, and we'll get at that a little bit later, but it struck me as I read through the text, that's the first time I realized that the name Barak is actually in the Bible. Didn't occur to me that Barack Obama had his name in the Bible. And I've been always saying it Barak, but now I'm going to say it Barak. And I will reserve only one comment about that for later on as we get to that. Well, life can be quite unpredictable, and I appreciate Carl for your sermon already on that. It's been very good to hear a good reflection on that already, so I don't have to say that much more. I will say a few things. Life can be quite unpredictable, yet predictable. The unpredictable is always waiting, even though there are some predictable things in our lives. The unpredictable is always waiting in the wings, you might say. We just had our civil elections here, and I live in Ladner. There wasn't much unpredictable things that happened there. Our mayor, Lois Jackson, although it was closer than I thought it would be, but we expected she'd get back in. I kind of expected Peter Ladner would get in here, but I guess things got a little undone in the last little while with that little secrecy that was going on. And it's interesting because now this is the mayor of the Olympics, right? And I think Peter had something in mind there. But I have a great appreciation for Peter Ladner, by the way, because I'm on the board of directors for the Place of Refuge, the drug and alcohol recovery house that's being developed right on Fraser and 49th. And when we were in city council back, it was actually on February 14th, Valentine's Day, at City Hall, having a discussion with the City Council, and had a huge number of people who were fighting against the idea of having a recovery house in their backyard. Peter Ladner was one of those that spoke up and said, you know, but this is not what it is. They were, the fear of a recovery house actually bringing more crime and more drug use into their neighborhood. You know, he was the one that spoke up and said, no. You know, this is not, we want to help your neighborhood to be more crime-free and bring this all down to a much healthier level. And he's the one who said that a house like this will in fact help that rather than encourage more drug use and crime. So I developed a bit of an appreciation for Peter in that sitting of City Council. I'm sure Gregor will be good. Recently, we've also had federal elections here and across the border, and I was thinking, what was unpredictable about our federal election in Canada? Well, probably it goes back a year or two. The unpredictable thing was that Stéphane Dion got in as the Liberal leader, and Bob Rae and Michael Ignatieff somehow missed out on that one as the front runners. That was probably the unpredictable thing, and then the rest of it, I think, since then was a bit predictable. But and then across the border, I was thinking, well, what was unpredictable there? The only thing I could think of was that Sarah Palin showed up on the scene. that was, I don't think anybody saw that coming. but in our Mennonite church here, we've celebrated the covenant signing about a year and a half ago to, you know, sort of re-covenant the marriage, so to speak, and it was a really great time. I'm sure some of you were at the celebration at MEI back on May the 27th of 07. The one unpredictable thing that none of us saw coming, and it was that there would be one congregation that really wants to belong to the whole, but wanted to abstain from signing. And the concept of abstaining to us was an interesting concept that we hadn't prepared ourselves for. And so we're still in conversation with the Abbotsford Mennonite Fellowship to find out what it is that they, their hopes and their vision is, and how they can be part of this. You know, when we said that signing the covenant was simply an acknowledgement to say this is where we belong, this is where we consider our place, our community to be, is the Mennonite Church BC. And we just didn't think it was going to be. We knew that some would not sign, and two congregations have left our conference, but we didn't expect the idea of abstaining from signing that from a congregation that really wants to be in. And so we're trying to figure that out. And we ask your prayers. We do, really, because we really want to work this out so that it's good, and that, you know, this congregation can find their way, and that we, you know, there's a lot of congregations that wrestled hard with deciding whether they would sign the covenant or not, because they were on the opposite end, in a sense, not knowing whether they would belong or not, and had suspicions of the conference, and in the meantime said, you know, that we will sign, we will say this is where we belong, and we're going to make this work. And for the hard struggle that some of them went through, you know, we find it difficult to continue with one congregation that's part of us but not signing, you know, and so we're looking for wisdom in knowing how to come out good in this, and how all of us can find a way to be part of Mennonite Church BC in this setting. Well, our MCC meetings went really well yesterday as well. I'm very thankful for all of the leadership there, and I don't know if there was anything new and unpredictable in those meetings. I know the one thing that's different about the church that I took note of, giving comparison to our elections that have taken place here, that we have people scrambling and campaigning in the civic and national and provincial levels to get into office. In the church, we tend to have to twist people's arms to let their names stand. And you know, that's not sure why we don't have campaigning for office in the church. But, you know, we're thankful for those who are willing to let their names stand when their shoulders are tapped, you know. And so that's often a huge amount of discernment in our nominations committees to find out who could we ask to let their names stand to become part of the ministries that have been considered important. Well, I mentioned earlier that I had been on a trip to Palestine, Israel, and I just wanted to say a few words about some of the unpredictable things that I had run into there. I mean, I grew up in this Bible college sort of setting where we, it was kind of the theological perspective was more of a dispensational theological perspective, and the importance of the place of 1948 and the coming together of the nation of Israel and all of that, and not thinking in terms of what that meant for those who were already there before 1948 happened, and then recognizing all of the struggles that have happened, and the pain and the oppression that has taken place since this new dispensation of the nation of Israel. To be there, one of the things that really struck me, we met a number of really good groups that are working hard to bringing justice, equal justice for all. There was a guy by the name of Rabbi Asherman. Works with an organization called Rabbis for Human Rights, and he's a fellow that has stood in front of bulldozers that have been bulldozing down Palestinian homes because they didn't have building permits. And he has some amazing stories of how he's been able to stand in the way of injustice. There was also another young Israeli gentleman, quite a dark-skinned fellow, actually. I think he was one of those, as there are many, who could be mistaken for being a Palestinian. And that's the sad part of the story, is that you know, people are judged according to, you know, the shape of their face and the color of their skin. But this organization was called ICAD, Israeli Coalition Against Home Demolition, House Demolition, I think it was. And he gave us a tour of some of the you know, realities that are there regarding the demolition of houses, and some of the stories of people who have fought long and hard to build their house and paid huge amounts of money in order to get a building permit and still never got it, and so therefore went ahead and built a home anyway and had it demolished because now it was built without a permit and built illegally, and you know, those very sad stories. The saddest piece of that for me that I remember is that there's like 80% of the homes that are like just to give you a little bit of a picture, you may know more about this than I do, but there's three ways in which three sort of sections in the Palestine-Israel political landscape. One is the fully Israeli-controlled area, then there's one area that's controlled both, and then there's the fully Palestinian-controlled area as well. In the joint-controlled areas and the fully Israeli-controlled areas, those are the places where this whole building permit issue is happening. And so there's 80% of the Palestinians living in those areas are living in homes that are considered to be illegal. And so they, at any time, may have a segment of the military standing in front of their home and bulldozers around their home to take it down because it's illegal. These people have lived in these homes for generations, but they still never know. They don't know if their home will be chosen as the one to get bulldozed. And that unpredictability of not knowing, you know, and raising your family, not knowing if your house is going to get bulldozed in a matter of hours or a couple of days, is a huge travesty. It's just a terrible way to live, I would think. So that's a pretty sad thing. But the hope of the Palestinian Christians was quite something. I remember, and if you read the Canadian Mennonite, I made a little bit of a comment in the part that I wrote about our trip in the Canadian Mennonite, about this gentleman with the most interesting name, Zugby Zugby. Don't know what his parents were thinking, but his name is Zugby Zugby, and he's just the most endearing leader in the Palestinian Christian world. He's from Bethlehem area, and he was saying, we met with him, and he seemed so hopeful. Only hours before we met with him, we were in a Muslim school listening to one of the Muslim teachers there, and he was saying that we asked him, you know, do you see the light at the end of the tunnel? And he says, I don't even see the tunnel. He was so without hope. And here's Zugby Zugby. He was filled with hope. And we asked him in the end, well, what is it? Well, he says, well, we Palestinian Christians, we have this incurable malady called hope. I said, wow. Incurable malady called hope. Many of them are leaving, and that's kind of one of the things that's frustrating, because the Palestinian Christians often have a bit more wherewithal than do the Muslims, and have found connections outside that have given them opportunity to leave and move to a different country where they can live without the oppression, and so there is that population of Palestinian Christians is getting smaller and smaller. Well, that's about that story. What is later on? I guess we have a discussion time or a sharing time, and I also want to ask questions of you as well. And the one question that I'd like you to think about, particularly, is an invitation to discuss what is this congregation's missional vision. What are your hopes and your imaginations for what lies ahead, and what is the mission that you're currently involved with? So that's simply one question that I wouldn't mind some thoughts on as well. With our walk with God and in the love and forgiveness of Jesus Christ, when this is our constant, when we know God. And the love and forgiveness of Jesus Christ is our strength and constant, no matter how unpredictable life can be. I would like to suggest that we are set for a prosperous and fulfilling future when we know that our constant is the love of God in Jesus Christ. I want to turn back to the passage from Judges, and if you have your Bibles with you, I encourage you to look there as well. It's a most interesting passage, and I was kind of wondering what to do with it when I first looked at it. So we want to take a few thoughts from that passage. The book of Judges consists of a series of short stories that follow a set of four-part pattern, in which usually these are the four parts. Israel sins, God judges or punishes Israel by having a neighbor nation threaten them. Thirdly, Israel calls for the help out of their situation and need, and God then raises up a savior in the form of a judge who leads Israel against their enemy. So we have the sin, God's judgment, punishment through the neighboring nations, Israel calling for help, God raising up a judge who leads them, leads Israel against their enemy. And the overarching sin of Israel, which takes somewhat different forms in distinct contexts throughout the book, is that they do not defeat all the nations of Canaan as God commanded them. They're not fully obedient in completing the task, and they end up making relationships with these. They try to build some kind of coalition with these nations that they were supposed to defeat, and in that, seeking security by doing that ends up being the very thing that maintains their insecurity and keeps them always on the edge of or outside of that security that they were hoping for. So because Israel was not pure in their quest of holy war, which is what God was calling them to and telling them to, instead they make these treaties and they live with this in security. Let's look at the text here. Verses 2 and 3. So the Lord sold them into the hands of Jabin, king of Canaan, who reigned in Hazor. Sisera, the commander of his army, was based in Harosheth, I don't know how to pronounce this one, Haggiyim, because he had 900 chariots fitted with iron and had cruelly oppressed the Israelites for 20 years, they cried to the Lord for help. It's interesting the technological advantage that Sisera seems to enjoy. It seems like the iron working age was not quite with the Israelites at that time. It was first introduced by the Philistines around 1200 BC, and the Israelites never quite mastered that trade. And so here is Sisera who had the iron chariots and apparently had metal spikes in the armor and things that the Israelites didn't have. And it was very intimidating because of having this technological advancement. And apparently for 20 years had been inflicting terror on the Israelites, and here they were crying out to the Lord, and that's where our passage from Psalm 123 comes in. It's a passage of crying out to the Lord, and looking at especially the last little section there, the last piece of Psalm 123 talks about we have endured no end of, and I use today's NIV, TNIV version, we have endured no end of ridicule from the arrogant and of contempt from the proud. And that's how this story in Judges is another one of those stories of this kind of ridicule from those who had technological advancement and the contempt that was coming from them because of this power over them. And so we have here then this cry out for help. It's an interesting piece in this text, which was the same. Did you use the NRSV? Is that the translation you were working with?
Yeah.
The concept that the Lord sold them into the hands, I was wondering about what does that mean? And I looked that up, and it seems as though it's not necessarily an exchange of currency, selling them into the hands of these people, but an abandonment of the people, putting them fully at the disposal of the powers of these Canaanite people. and sort of implying the handing over of the people into the hands of their enemies. And so here they are crying for help again. Now Deborah, this is where the unpredictable piece comes up. Here is Barak, or Barak, and the one piece that I was going to compare between Obama and this Barak is that Barak here comes up as is looking like the wimp, you know, whereas Barak has come up as looking like the leader that's going to carry the nation into a bright and hopeful future. Barak here comes up short, and it's the unpredictable piece here is that Deborah becomes a hero. And if we had read the passage on even further, we would even see not only does the woman Deborah become the hero here, and Barak is kind of the wimp who's actually the commander of the army and has all kinds of resources at his disposal, but when it comes time to face Sisera and his army, he sort of says, Deborah, won't you come along? Like, I mean, I need you by my side. You know, I can't do this on my own. You know, and she says, sure, I'll come along. But because you've asked me to come along, and because you're not willing to take this in, willing to really trust God, that if God has said we should, that He will be with you and He will lead you into this campaign, and you are not willing to trust Him, then you also won't get the glory for it either. And the one who gets the glory is not only an Israelite woman named Deborah, but then later on the person of Jael. Jael, who with this gruesome picture of Jael pounding the tent peg into the temple of Sisera to actually be, you know, bring the victory, the final victory. And here she is, a Kenite, you know, a Canaanite woman who's alongside of Deborah, the co-hero of this story, and that is clearly the piece of the unpredictable nature of this particular text, and it rises up, you know, in the whole story of the people of Israel, this possibility of leaning on the women to be the leaders, and also leaning on even a person who's not part of the family of faith, and a woman as well as being another hero who comes through. And it's unpredictable and news and something to ponder for the people of Israel, and that's the piece that I was taking out of this text. It's very interesting that what's being suggested is that it was a Bedouin situation in that sense because Sisera, if we would have read further on into the text, verses 13, 14, and on. Sisera, who's fleeing after being defeated by God, and Barak being the one who led in this defeat, runs and hides. You know, everybody's, you know, getting wiped out, but somehow Sisera gets off of his steed and heads off into running and hiding on foot into this tent, of Jael. And Jael is, you know, the suggestion, because they're living in tents, they're probably mobile and moving around, and it's likely similar to what the Bedouin folks are like today in Israel. And the sense of the hospitality of the Bedouin people and the Kenites, who are the particular group here, is something that's almost a religious virtue. To transgress that, Jael very clearly for the sake, whether it's of God's call or for it's the sake of knowing what's the right thing to do, welcomes Sisera into her tent, you know, covers him up, makes him warm, lets him fall asleep so that she can drive a tent peg through his temple, you know. He totally believed that her hospitality was in keeping with the standard that would be expected. And so he completely submitted to that wonderful hospitality. But she knew that there was a greater purpose in mind here, and proceeded to completely go in the face of what was known to be the right thing as far as hospitality was concerned. And I think it'd be interesting to go into a Bedouin community. We saw a lot of Bedouin houses or tin shacks or whatever, you know, they were quite quite basic, or scattered around the hills of Israel. But it would be interesting to just walk up and see, you know, what kind of hospitality, because it seems as though that's the norm, that anybody who comes to a Bedouin community obviously is in need of hospitality, and they know that that's what they will offer. I never did that, so next time if I ever get a chance to go to Israel again, I would like to do that. That's another sad piece, by the way, in the story of the people of Israel, in that the Bedouin communities, because they are such, you know, poorly, you know, like very basic places, are for the most part considered to be garbage. And so that if ever a Bedouin community is the bulldozers come and wipe it out, it on the official sort of scale of things is considered cleaning up garbage. Well, it's the homes of real people who have, you know, camels and animals scattered on the hills around. So, this is the story. And what is the significance of this story? Well, there's a temptation to go into the end result and looking at, you know, the completion of the story and even the song of Deborah that follows in chapter 5. But we do want to hold it to the first few verses 1 through 10, particularly, and looking at that particular theme there. And although we can find some identity in this intrigue of Jael being the hero, the second hero there, we want to keep our thoughts here, where Deborah and Barak represent two very different faith stances at a moment of crisis. Deborah is being idealized in this passage as a prophet and a judge who trusts in God at all costs. She delivers a message of holy war to Barak in verses 6 and 7, and again in the moment of confrontation with the Canaanite army, she is the one who is able to see God marching before Israel, and thus is able to lead the army of Barak into battle. Barak is a much more calculating person in this story. And even though he is presented as a holy warrior with no less than 10,000 troops, when he is confronted by the prophetic summons of Deborah, he hesitates. And he then responds in verse 8 with a condition. He will go into battle only if Deborah accompanies him. The story does not condemn Barak, but neither does it idealize him. It sets him up as somewhat of an average person. Deborah and Jael are the heroes of this story. And so this is where I would like to ask us some questions of ourselves. Where are we at? Are we a congregation that's merely average in faith? Do we hesitate before acting? Or are we heroic, taking courage, stepping forth into the unpredictable world that we have with courage based on our convictions? I would like to leave us also with the confidence and the assurance that it is our faith in Jesus that carries us when situations turn into an unpredictable way. And I'd like to encourage us that it is our faith in Jesus that gives us the ability to let new perspectives take shape in our worldview. I believe that the unpredictable things that come into our lives are there to alert us to reconsider or to rethink what it is that we have sometimes held to be right and true for long periods of time, and to give us cause for pause and to let these perspectives enter into our worldview and shape us as to who we are. I certainly was shaped in my time in Palestine and Israel, and continue to be shaped by the encounters that I have with many congregations across British Columbia, and even some new congregations that are considering membership with Mennonite Church BC, who are coming from a slightly different worldview and orientation than what I've grown up with. And it's intriguing, yet at the same time, one needs to walk carefully, but also courageously. And so while you may have questions for me, this is the question I'd like to leave with you too, as to where you are at in your place as a congregation, whether you are merely average or whether you are hesitant or whether you are courageous and heroic. and to ask what is the predictable and unpredictable at Point Grey Mennonite Fellowship. And then lastly, to reiterate the question I asked earlier, what is your missional vision and your passion as a congregation? Amen.